he's given us different little bits of information at different times, all are very varying, so any faith I have in him is pretty much gone. So what I do know, he's male. Gee, I didn't know that. He's white. I wasn't sure about that either. But he does have A positive blood. And in June 1981, he walked in the clinic where I've now parked myself, masturbated into a cup, sold his sperm, or to be more precise, he sold his biological ties, and for $50 disappeared into the anonymous wilderness forever. And to my knowledge, he has never had to look back and wonder what became of his sperm. And his sperm did not say sperm, as you see, as I am standing here in front of the front of you today. And I wonder what he used this money for. Did he use it to buy books? What did my conception finance? I'm 24 years old. I've grown up in a relatively average family, loved by not perfect parents, those don't exist, but both perfect with good intentions. When I was 5, I asked my mom where babies came from, and she told me a simple story of seeds and an egg. It made me feel special and loved, and I was. I remember thinking it was really cool, and I don't think I thought much of it over the next couple of years. And I told a few friends along the way, and they kind of, again, you're 7 or 8, and okay, that's nice, what's on TV? It was never anything more, and I thought I was really unique. I remember asking my mom to tell me again. I was like, tell me the story again. I'm like, how, what happened? But again, you know, the narrative that she told me was her narrative. You know, mommy and dad basically was that, you know, mommy and daddy had extra seeds, or mommy and daddy needed extra seeds, and so they went to the doctor. However, for me, I knew instinctively at the age of 5 that I didn't get any sperm, and that this man was in fact my biological father. I always had questions. What did he look like? What did he do? Who was he? It was just an instinctive thing, and it grew with time. And of course, as you get older and your understanding of the world changes and understanding becomes more complex, your questions become more complex. And I remember when I was in elementary school, I think it was grade 5, we had to do a family tree, and you did where your ancestors are from. And my mom's from England, and I don't know, I didn't find the most exciting country to research about. And I remember thinking, I was like, what are the sperm donors from? Like, it was somewhere really far away. And I remember I had a best friend at the time, and she had this family tree that went back, and she's probably one of the few people, it went back to like the 1400s. And she knew both sides in detail, and I just looked at it, and I remember just being so envious. I was like, I want to know. I'm like, what, who? Could have been anybody, anything. And just I was relating to all of this to who I was becoming. How did it fit into me? There's all these other factors, but this was where I started from. I've had people ask me that if I had the most perfect father in the world and the most perfect relationship with him, would that change how I feel about wanting to know who the identity was of my biological father? And as far as I'm concerned, they're two separate things. My dad is my dad, and I love him. But I do have a biological father out there who doesn't even know I exist, and whose existence on this planet is totally anonymous for me, and I'm positive I will continue to be curious about him. Anonymous. What does that mean? We often hear talking about anonymous sperm, anonymous donations, but we never talk about anonymous biological parents, and that is what my situation is. Anonymous biological father. I know he's white, male, and again in Vancouver in 1981. I feel violated when contemplating the possibilities of who he could have been. Was he passing through town? Was he a medical student? Did he live nearby? Did he do this regularly? Or in the present, I see the homeless guy I pass every day on the street. See the personality I see on TV. Who is he? And, you know, just an antidote, sometimes my mind plays tricks on me. Like when I was on the plane on the way here, there was this gentleman sitting next to me, and I can't remember, he'd been on the plane in Vancouver, and the plane was delayed, and we were kind of laughing about running around the airport, and we were talking, and, you know, again, my mind, without even intending to, it's kind of like, oh, I wonder if it could be him. I'm kind of looking at him. You're from Vancouver? Let's see. What do you look like? And I'm serious. It's not that far away from my mind. It never has been. And maybe to you this might seem a little kind of like, oh, that's crazy, but it's been my reality for my whole life. And then sometimes it's kind of neat. You're like, wow, it could be the greatest person, but there's another side to it where I'm like, what am I related to? A thief, crook, a liar? And I don't, you know, God, I don't want to think about that. What I think oftentimes too is when I've spoken to people who've been adopted, there's oftentimes in adoptee stories where they have fantasies about their biological parents. Oh, I was a movie star, you know, and I've experienced that. I remember one time when I was younger, I thought it would be Prince Charles and I'd be the Queen of England. And, you know, and I think I'll continue to live with it. And I suppose at one point, when I'm 40, 50, 60, I'll know that he wasn't around anymore, and maybe then I'll stop looking for his face. I don't know. Anyway, that leads on to what I've written, which is, when I'm 80 years old and I've lived most of my life, will I still drive by this clinic and wonder about him? I have no doubt I will. I have my whole life ahead of me, yet the mystery of the man who helped give me life is a phantom that continues to haunt me. Perhaps I will see glimpses of him on the faces of my future children. Perhaps, without realizing it, I have the same mannerisms or interests of him as him. I'll never know. And it is the not knowing that hurts so much, as it is such a huge loss. And I feel anger too. Anger that I should not have to be in the dark about the man who gave me half of my genes and contributed to the person I am today. Anger at the fact that I have no legal recourse, no way of being able to claim my right and establish my full identity. As according to the medical doctor who performed the procedure, I am the treatment to my parents' infertility. The perspective was and continues to be so short-sighted that all the focus is placed on achieving pregnancy. Any thought to long-term physical, emotional, and psychosocial well-being of the health of the child is not giving any priority or any consideration. I did not negotiate the terms of my conception. I was not there. So often my mom has spoken of this, and Elizabeth definitely touched on this, where the drive is so much, I want to be pregnant, in that place of wanting a child so badly. And then, like my mom has said, all of a sudden you were born, and it wasn't about me anymore. It was about you. And I know she said she felt this, oh, shit, what's happened? And I think that's what's been driving the cause of this, is that it is the way that the medical profession has approached this is on, well, pregnant, job done, and it's not. This is a future citizen. I'm an adult. I'm not a baby anymore. I'm going to be a mother. Hopefully, I'll be older. There were decisions that were made for me before I was born, and I'm the one who lives with the consequences. The doctor, it's just his job. My parents have had repercussions from this as well too. But it doesn't go away once the baby arrives. So the clinic where my conception occurred is no longer located inside the building, but the building still remains. Looking at it, I feel overwhelming sadness. This place is the only connection I have to the man who helped give me life, and to whom I'm his biological daughter. A couple of years ago, out of curiosity, I decided to locate the doctor's name on the building directory. It was gone. I went up to the fourth floor where the clinic had been located for the past 25 years, and it was now a dental practice. The doctor's name, any connection, however small I had to my past, to my records, to anything, disappeared. I felt invisible. This was an outrage. Didn't he have an obligation to let his former patients and the children he helped create know that he'd retired? What happened to the records, if any existed at all? Didn't Vital Statistics or some other governmental health agency have a responsibility to keep track of his practice? Shouldn't have it been recorded on my birth certificate? I felt illegitimate, unrecorded. My conception is a complete mystery, and this is reflecting the failures of the doctors and to the government for not adequately keeping track of what the medical profession does. That's changed a little bit, but I still think we've got miles to go on that. For all intents and purposes, it might as well have never happened, and for all intents and purposes, my conception might as well have never occurred. The essence of me, of where my life started, is nowhere to be found. Sometimes I feel like, as my life exists now and as it will be in the future, some sort of medical experiment. What do I mean by that? But no one in the medical profession, the ones who pioneered the technique of donor insemination, and we can insert, I think Elizabeth commented on this as well too, we can insert any other new reproductive technology, pioneering human cloning, whatever we want. The donor insemination of the same shock value cloning did 60 years ago, but the level of kind of ethical outrage about it keeps on moving further and further. No one in the medical profession who pioneered this technique, and it started in the 1890s and about 60 years in Canada, and they haven't bothered to follow up on the results. People such as myself, to see what we think and feel in this process. So I am completely in agree with Elizabeth when she says that there needs to be more research about this. It's imperative. It's a complete contradiction to the Hippocratic Oath, and it's a complete violation of, or a complete contradiction in how scientific research should be conducted, which is hypothesis, method, results, and conclusions. They haven't gotten beyond the technique yet, or rather the results end when the pregnancy is achieved. I'm not a pregnant belly. I'll have to live with these decisions for the rest of my life. Furthermore, the level of commercialization found nowadays in egg, sperm, and embryo transaction is absolutely appalling, and in contrast to the small way it used to be run out of a gynecologist's office, which was the case in my conception. It is a baby factory. I'm not saying that for shock value. It literally is. The parts that make the babies are for sale, custom order, packaged, guaranteed not to have any issues. All you have to do is look on a website of any clinic. It's a marketing of product. It's cute babies and deliveries. And again, I say this with compassion for people who are going through infertility issues, but I do think they're being exploited by these clinics. And I have experienced this firsthand. When I have spoken out at large infertility medical conference organizations, I am dismissed as having problems. Yes, that's right. I do have issues with this. Who wouldn't? The medical profession or business who runs the clinic does not want to hear what I have to say. After all, I'm the product. I'm defective if I have issues with this and if I vocalize them. My parents were the consumer, and they call them consumers. I'm not using these first. This is literally, they talk, you go to these conferences and they have these big billboards up of the latest presentations. These are what the consumers are asking for, and there's no consumption. Where's the consumption here? And this, the fact that this terminology is in this practice speaks volumes about the nature of it being so commercial and such a commercial transaction. My parents were the customer, and they negotiated the business transaction, and the result is supposed to be a cute, cuddly baby who will never question where they came from and will always be happy with the decisions of the adults who are made without their consent. And this often comes back to what you touched on earlier this morning about it being a very self-centered, a very me-driven, I want my baby now, I want, and I hear this oftentimes, and when I've spoken out at conferences where there are infertility patients there, and it's this sense of entitlement or right to a child at any cost, and I sometimes I speak out and I'm like, I'm your child in the future, can you please listen to what I am saying. You have to think beyond that. And I had a friend last week, and she's 32, and she's in a relationship with a great guy. And she turned around to me and she said, well, he's not very attractive. She said, I know this really gorgeous guy in Africa, and I think that's just the best place. She's like, I want a beautiful baby. And I was looking at her and I'm thinking, what are you thinking? Why, where is your sense, and this is something that we've heard this afternoon, your sense of responsibility towards being a parent to your future child? It's about what parenting can do for them, not what they can do for helping, being a parent towards their future child. And it's very frustrating. I'm just going to conclude here a little bit. I would say I'm by all means functional in my life. I've gone to university, have lived abroad twice, volunteered in Asia, traveled, worked, have been in love, have a wide circle of friends, and I'm generally content with where things are going and excited about my future. I've been told in the past that compared to most people in the world, I have nothing to complain about. This is true in some respects. This summer, part of my time was spent in Cambodia, volunteering with drug-addicted, abused, and oftentimes sexually exploited street children. Cambodia is a country where many injustices have occurred and continue to occur, affecting large segments of the population. Naturally, it was very upsetting to witness this while I was spending my time there. However, this does not change the fact that to deliberately create someone to deny them knowledge and presence and company of their kin is an injustice. Yes, I have a lot in my life to be positive about, but no matter the size, no matter the scale, an injustice is an injustice. So to conclude, if you ever do meet a man who sold his parentage for $50 in June of 1901, can you please tell him that his daughter is looking for him? I just want to know who he was.
Right away, me, Olivia. Olivia, you don't get off that easy, so thank you so much. It's a pleasure to have you here. This is a little token of our time with us here today. Okay. Thank you so much. As you can tell, that's a passionate story. It's a story that enacts a part of Elizabeth's paper. It's a part that that brings it to life, that it's not just theory and philosophy, it's a real person. There are real issues there. And I'm just thankful you could share that with us today, Olivia. Thank you so much.